Take your minds back to that marvellous opening line in Gabriel Garcia Marquez's magical novel, magical realist novel, 100 Years of Solitude. The colonel is facing the firing squad and he remembers, and I quote, that distant afternoon when his father took him to discover ice. Well, ice is something strange and miraculous in the book, not just a humdrum compound made up of hydrogen and oxygen atoms. And it's clear that my next guest, Max Leonard, is also striving to restore the mystery of ice. In his new book, A Cold Spell, Max takes a deep dive into the history of our human relationship with ice, exploring how the frosty stuff has shaped art, science, and civilization over the ages. And I'm delighted that Max is on the blower from chilly London. Welcome to our little wireless program. Max, the eureka moment, please, when you decided to tackle the substance.
Oh, hi, Philip, and thanks for having me on. And I first got an inkling of maybe writing something about ice when I was at an academic conference in Newcastle, and that's Newcastle, northeast of England, not Newcastle, New South Wales. And after the first day, we were going to have a meal together in a pub, and I was sitting there waiting for the other participants. And behind the bar, there was a TV, and there was a news report from Greenland, and you know, it was a hot summer's day, and the reporter was there with a kind of torrent of ice water flowing from a glacier, you know, melt water, and there was clearly bad news being communicated about global warming and the climate, and you know, these things that are happening, but very, very far away from, you know, where most of us live, sort of at the edges of our vision. And I was sitting there with a Coke with some ice cubes in, and suddenly I kind of looked at it and I thought, wow, you know, ice is in my drink, but how does it relate to the ice on the screen? And how do we relate to ice in the natural world? And ice is actually something that, you know, it has been miraculous, and it has been, you know, a real force in the natural world, in the human world. But these days we kind of take it for granted, and it's everywhere in our lives. You know, we grow it in a little box in the corner of the kitchen, and we can have it whenever we want. But, you know, you tell that to someone a few hundred years ago and they would marvel at you. And so the more I started thinking about it, I guess, the more I realized how important it had become to human life. And, just really wanted to explore that and kind of maybe rekindle that wonder and that, you know, connection with the natural world at the same time.
You know, reading the book, I was taken back to childhood when we had an ice chest, and the bloke that delivered wood by horse would then swap and start delivering ice to us, which we'd stick in the ice chest. We'll probably get round to refrigeration a little later. You write about wanting to take us back when ice was seen as something inexplicable and miraculous. So there's a wonderful chapter in your book about the little ice age in London. Tell us about the frost fairs on the River Thames.
Yeah, well, the little ice age is the name commonly given to a period, kind of starts maybe 1400-ish, but around the end of the 16th century, so around 1600, there's a real noticeable change in temperature across certainly the UK, Western Europe, North America, and disrupted weather patterns elsewhere as well. But you know, the temperature falls maybe a degree, maybe a bit more, and we all know now that how with temperature changes, even though they might, you know, on average be seemingly quite little, how this causes really disruptive weather patterns for everyone. But so yes, around 1600, say the temperature decreased, and between those years, there were something like 24 winters when the Thames in central London froze over completely. And after a while, you know, people started going on the ice, and the boatmen couldn't do any work. You know, there was only a few bridges in London at the time, so quite a lot of people would pay boatmen to go from one side of the river to the other. Suddenly they couldn't take anyone across because it was all frozen up. They had no work, so they kind of started what we now call frost fairs. So, you know, there'd be stalls opened up, then someone might start roasting an ox, and then, you know, a barber shop would set up. Yeah, I know the idea of you know, fire on the river seems a little, you
But
know,
there was
scary.
archery, there was bear fighting, heavens above. There's sledding and drinking Dutch whimsy. What was that?
Dutch whimsy, I think, was some kind of game where you kind of whirled yourself around and sort of like a roundabout today. But you know, they became these sites of, you know, sort of like Shakespearean, you know, licentiousness and revelry and like Midsummer Night's Dream, where everything's turned upside down, and you know, everyone mixes in the same place, and you know, they were outside of the normal bounds of the city, so they'd you know, it was like anything could happen, and this magical space that had been conjured up out of this frost, out you know, that was equally going to disappear quite soon as well. So
I was an addict of Pepys's diaries, and I learned from you that the good Samuel skated with the king's mistress, Nellie Gwynne.
yeah, he did, and this was King Charles II. So King Charles II had started as a very you know, in the Restoration. So after the Civil War, and he had come back in and sort of brought a whole, you know, great like feeling of life and joy to London again. But at some point he started, you know, cracking down on the theatres and cracking down on printing presses and dissent and things like this. But he even got out on the ice himself.
Now the ice finally thaws, but London frost fairs immediately, well, they're immortalized, of course, in art. And speaking of art, you decided to devote a whole chapter of your book to paintings and books inspired by ice. And I note that you have a favorite, and that's Kurt Vonnegut, who was a guest on the program a couple of times. Tell us about his satirical novel, Cat's Cradle.
Oh wow, that's incredible. You had Kurt Vonnegut on. I feel honored to be following in his footsteps. But yeah, Cat's Cradle is what my favorite of his books, I think. He published it in 1963, and this was kind of the height of the Cold War. And he tells a story about Ice Nine, which is quite interesting because this actually has a basis in scientific reality. Throughout the 20th century, people have been finding different forms of ice. You know, ice is normal ice that we know, the ice you'd put in your drink, or that freezes on a river or in the Arctic. It's a crystalline structure, and it arranges itself in a kind of regular lattice. And this is why snowflakes are six-sided, like all school children know. But if you put ice under pressure, or if you put it, you know, take it very far out into space, there's different ways that it can form. And so this was very current science when Kurt was, you know, post-war in the 60s. And there are different phases of ice. Then Ice Nine did exist, but he imagined this substance that would cause any water to it touches to freeze instantly. And thus would, you know, be a kind of threat to the whole world if it got into the wrong hands. And in the book, unfortunately, it does. It gets into the hands of a kind of weird, aging tin pot dictator on an unnamed island country. Very odd.
I didn't know that the science behind the book was inspired by Kurt's brother Bernard.
Yeah, well, it's funny because Bernard Vonnegut, actually, in this time period we're talking about, the early 60s, he was the most famous of the Vonnegut brothers. He was a very well-reputed scientist, and he'd been working on ice for the US government in the Second World War. And after the war, he got a job at General Electric, where he actually helped Kurt to get a job there too. And Kurt didn't go as a scientist, he went as a copywriter, but he must have known what Bernard was up to there, because Bernard, in his work at General Electric, had made a significant discovery that ice can be caused to seed. So whether that's on the wing of an airplane as it goes through cloud, ice seeds and forms crystals, or you can cause ice to seed in clouds. And so by dropping various substances into a cloud, you can cause the water that's held there to nucleate and then fall as snow. And this is kind of cutting edge science at the time. And it looked like, there would be ways that we could control the weather.
So Bernard encouraged his struggling younger brother Kurt to join the same lab.
He did. I think Kurt wasn't actually working on Bernard's experiments, which by that time were classified because they were being part run by the military. But Kurt must have known what was going on because this idea of ice seeding and, creating some kind of tangible effect in the outside world is something that he took on for his book Cat's Cradle, which, although it's about ice, is really kind of an interesting example of a sort of subconscious nuclear dread that there's somehow this substance in the world that can, potentially destroy everything.
Every page I turn, there's some new revelation about ice, and I'd like you to tell me about the idea of the Berg ships.
Oh yeah, this is one of my funniest and interesting stories, I think, which again dates to the Second World War. I think in the Second World War, a huge problem for the Allies and for Winston Churchill was the amount of shipping being lost to U-boats in the North Atlantic. Britain needed supplies being brought in huge quantities, and there was no real way of defending ships coming over from America from the U-boats and from German attack because we didn't have planes that could fly that far. We didn't have enough, gunboats and navy to look after merchant shipping. And this was, almost catastrophic for the war effort. And so Churchill and Mountbatten both turned to a guy called Geoffrey Pike, who had a really kind of crazy idea to make icebergs, synthetic icebergs that you so big and so well made that you could put a runway on it and land airplanes there. And so in there in the middle of
So
the
you're
North
talking
Atlantic.
about an aircraft carrier made out of ice.
Yeah, exactly. And so you could land a plane, you could reprovision it, and then it could fly off and look after the shipping.
So despite the outlandish nature of the idea, Mountbatten and Churchill were enthusiastic.
They were, and there's even a story that Geoffrey Pike, after he was doing his experiments, he'd been installed in a kind of secret laboratory under Smithfield Meat Market, which is the meat market in central London. And so was there in a massive freezer experimenting with ice. A big, big
But
problem that
not
they had.
just plain ice, because they developed a wood pulp reinforced ice.
Well, exactly. And yeah, the big, big problem that they had was that, ice, which is a very, very strong material, is actually also quite brittle. So how, and you couldn't land a plane on a normal iceberg in the Atlantic. Although that said, there are huge icebergs in Antarctica where there are runways on. But for their purposes up there, it wasn't going to work. So they had to find a way of reinforcing and strengthening natural ice. And this is what Pike was working on in his secret laboratory in the meat locker. And what he came up with was a kind of adding wood pulp to it, which would significantly reinforce it and would also stop it from melting so quickly. And the story is that once he'd come up with this substance, he put some of it in some dry ice and rushed to Chequers to Churchill's weekend residence and surprised the Prime Minister in the bath with a piece of pykrete, they called it.
Pykrete. What a wonderful yarn. And for a variety of logistical and, political reasons, full-size Berg ships never saw the light of day. But you say that a scale model weighing 1,000 tons was actually built on a lake in Canada.
Yeah, they got quite far in their preparations for this, I think. And this scale model was made on a lake by Canadian conscientious objectors who I don't think they were told what their work was for, or else they might have objected even more. But yeah, this scale model was something like a 20th or a 50th of the size of a real thing. And as you say, it was thousands and thousands of tons, and it became clear that this thing would be completely unwieldy and So large.
I'm talking to Max Leonard about his new book, A Cold Spell, A Human History of Ice. Now, I understand ice also played a role in the Alps during the First World War. What was the so-called White War, and how were glaciers involved?
I really enjoyed researching this bit of the book because I came to the subject as someone who was a mountain man, I guess, and spent a lot of time in the Alps, and trekking up in the icy wastes up there. And the White War was an episode in the First World War, in the fight between Austria and Italy. So quite a lot of the border between those two countries is incredibly mountainous. Some of the peaks are going up to almost 4,000 meters. And so while a lot of the action, a lot of the real serious fighting took place in the lowlands, further east in what we now know as Slovenia, that's kind of Hemingway territory, the two countries faced off along the top of these peaks, all the way along their border, all the way to Switzerland. And it was just sort of a fantastic and otherworldly place. They'd be up over 3,000 meters. Some of the highest fighting of the war and of any war took place up there, 3,000 meters, 3,500 meters. They'd have lookout points and garrisons almost literally on the top of the highest mountains in that part of the Alps. But as you can probably well appreciate, all these troops, all this effort, all this material needed supplies, and supply lines from the lowlands up to the peaks would be very, very vulnerable to enemy fire.
An Austrian engineer called Leo Handel thought that had the bright idea of digging tunnels through the glacier.
Well, he did, yeah, because in the glacier, you're in the ice. It's 0 degrees. It's not pleasant down there. But up on the surface might be minus 15, -20. There might be storms. There might be avalanches. And most importantly, you've got your enemy forces on the ridge overlooking you and taking pot shots at you. So Leo Handel first just started digging into the glaciers, through the crevasses, and eventually this whole system of tunnels developed in glaciers it's particularly one called the Marmalade, which was underneath one of the highest points of the war. And in the Marmalade developed what became known as the Ice Stadt, or Ice City. It was kilometers and kilometers and kilometers of tunnels dug into this glacier. And there was, men living down there. There was a chapel. There was an infirmary. There was a kind of, or at least for some of the war, there was a rudimentary system of electric lighting.
But the tunnels were dangerous, as you point out. They were constantly moving as the glacier shifted.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing with glaciers, is that you don't see it necessarily all the time, but they're moving, several centimetres a day sometimes. And so these tunnels would shift and crack, and it would require constant maintenance. And yes, there's danger up above, but I can't imagine sort of psychologically what that would do to you to be living in the bowels of this thing that was moving all the time, and constantly the earth, the ground beneath your feet could just disappear.
When does the idea of using ice to preserve food, when does that begin?
That's an interesting one, because obviously our relationship, with the relationship between ice and food is kind of pretty fundamental to us now. And actually, I found an academic who, at least in a paper that she wrote, sort of proposed the theory that there are Paleolithic ice pits which might have been used to store food. But certainly we can take the use of ice in our kind of food system back to the beginning of writing. So you can go back to Mesopotamia. This is about 5,000 years ago, like 3,200 BC, when you find cuneiform tablets talking about the ice trade in some of the city states in Mesopotamia. And so that means, this is the first writing. So that, I'm presuming that means that the use of ice must have well predated that. This is just simply the first time that it was recorded.
Tell me about the ice house.
Well, yeah, so this form of ice storage seems to have persisted for hundreds and even thousands of years. And take those earliest records in Mesopotamia. What they record is that, you know, they'd bring ice down from the neighboring mountains, and they'd put it in a kind of semi-subterranean storage house called an ice house, and they'd pack it very, very densely and insulate it. And this snow would then, being packed very densely, turn into ice, and it would last a very long time. So you could kind of use it as a resource, and ice was suddenly becoming a kind of commodity for the rich and affluent people of the society.
So the ancient Greeks and Romans also used snow to chill their drinks.
But yeah, and I think they did the same thing. It's recorded that they would bring ice down, snow down from the mountains, and store it, and then use this to chill their drinks. And the ancient Greeks had a kind of sophisticated, like amphora, which kind of works like a thermos flask does today, but instead of the kind of vacuum around the drink, you just pack in your snow. And the Romans had a kind of tea strainer kind of idea. So you would pass the drink through the ice in the tea strainer to cool it. But obviously, this presupposes that you have very, very, very clean ice, and that would have only been available to the most exalted people in the country.
Well, you cite Emperor Nero, and who seems to have invented the practice of packing snow around thin glass vessels filled with boiled water.
Yeah, that's true, and really points to me that. So this kind of interesting phenomenon that back then ice was used as something to chill drinks, and it was used to as something that we would consume, and it doesn't seem to me actually that the Romans and the Greeks were using it much to store food. They'd use it for medicine too. So there's various different authorities in both societies who would talk about different ways of curing illnesses with ice. And I think Romans would have had snow in their frigidariums, the cold rooms next to the caldariums, the kind of hot baths.
Unfortunately, time on the Little Wireless program doesn't move with glacial majesty, so let's move almost 2,000 years and arrive in the 19th century when ice becomes a highly lucrative business.
Yeah, and this is almost entirely down to a man called Frederick Tudor, who had became known as the Ice King of Boston. That's Boston, Massachusetts, in the States. And he came from a kind of quite high up but not very wealthy family, and he kind of had constant schemes to try and make some money. And from around 1805, he was trying to export ice from the lakes of Massachusetts to the Caribbean. So he would go to, you know, I think that first he
Sorry,
went to a lake.
why the Caribbean?
Well, he had this theory that in a hot country there was nothing more opulent and more desirable than to have a cold drink. And it wasn't really a very current idea, I don't think, at the time. But he thought that, you know, in a hot place you would want something cold, and this could be something that could be marketed and sold. So he took ice, which was freely available in the lakes around his farm, and he started attempting to ship it, you know, quite a long way. And 1806, he tried to send some to Martinique, and this failed. It all melted on the way. But he kept on going to the cities of the U.S. South, you know, kind of Louisiana, New Orleans, and Savannah in Georgia. But what he's the most famous for, actually, is taking it much, much further than that. And that happened in the 1830s when he succeeded in taking a shipment of ice to Calcutta in India.
Now, Mark Twain, wonderful fellow, visited Australia, visited the town of my birth, Maryborough in Victoria, where he was astonished by the preposterous, oversized railway station. But he wrote about ice. He said, "In my time, ice was jewelry. None but the rich could wear it." So when did it become more accessible?
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, in Europe especially, it seems to have been something that the elites would use and would enjoy from the Renaissance onwards, really. It kind of fell out of the knowledge got lost after the Romans and the Greeks, but it resurfaced in the Renaissance. But Mark Twain writing in, late 19th century in the US, he was really seeing the way that ice was being democratized. Those words that you quote were from a visit that he took to an ice manufacturing plant on the Mississippi.
I'm sorry, an
Technically,
ice manufacturing plant?
well, quite, yeah. So we move in the 19th century from people enjoying natural ice, cut from lakes, and it was terribly prized by people like Queen Victoria for its beautiful, transparent qualities, and it was, long lasting. But the science was available to manufacture ice, and it really became more and more prevalent as the 19th century went on. But in the States, at least, one of the big tipping points in the ice trade, away from natural ice to manufactured ice, was the American Civil War, because suddenly in the 1860s, Frederick Tudor had built up this ice trade between the cold North and the steamy South, and once the North and the South were fighting against each other, that was cut off, and all these people in New Orleans or Savannah, like I say, who'd got used to having chilled iced tea and using ice in their kitchens and for all the other reasons they did, suddenly were without it.
We're almost back to the ice cubes with which we began, and I'm assuming that the next stage in the history of ice was when someone invented the fridge. Who came up with that?
It's a funny thing, because it was really a sort of a technology that was looking for an application. The science was there from the middle of the 18th century. A guy called William Cullen had succeeded in freezing stuff by vaporizing a liquid, which is pretty much how a modern fridge works. But he didn't really seem to do it want to do anything with it. Richard Trevithick, who came along later in the early 19th century, he was the guy who invented one of the first locomotives, and so he was much more practical. And he thought maybe we could use steam engines to drive the whole process the same way, and suddenly have this kind of steam powered ice. But I guess one of the people that you would call the fathers of sort of modern refrigeration is a guy called William Gorrie. He was in Florida. He was a doctor, and he wanted ice to cool his patients, because at that point in time, yellow fever, malaria, diseases like that, we didn't know that they were transmitted by insects. We thought they were people thought they were airborne, and it seemed that warm air was worse than cool air. So he wanted ice in bulk to cool down his patients. So he invented a contraption which used the same principles of vapor compression to cool water and to make ice. But crucially for him, and this is the interesting bit, I think, is that he could see that there was an application for it in some kind of the food trade. And so he took this ice that he'd made in his hospital, and he took it to the local French consul, and they served chilled champagne on Bastille Day, thanks to his ice.
He was described by a journalist for the New York Globe as a crank.
Yeah, he wasn't. There's been this kind of ambiguity about ice all the way through its history. Elizabeth David, the great food writer, talked about Pliny denouncing the degenerate custom messing with the seasons of making ice in the heat. And I think John Gorrie got the same. People were suspicious of him for the same reasons. It seemed kind of ungodlike to it seemed to be trying to pretend to the position of gods, to be messing with nature in this way.
Look, our final moments together have melted away, and thanks for coming on, Max. That was absolutely fascinating. I've been talking to Max Leonard, author and journalist, whose latest book is A Cold Spell, A Human History of Ice, published by Bloomsbury.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.